Welcome once again to the Comic Book Historian Podcast. I'm Alex Grand with my co-host Jim Thompson. Today we are continuing the second half of the Mark Chiarello interview. Let's continue.
You know, since we're on this subject, one other thing. When we were talking to Tim Sale and with Chaykin, they both pretty much pronounced Dave Johnson as the best cover artist currently working and has been for a long time.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Dave, man. Dave's sensibilities and mine are really very similar. We both like real graphic images.
Yes.
I know Chaykin does, too. Dave's is such a hardcore designer. I mean, he could draw incredibly well. I wish I could draw like Dave Johnson can draw, but he just gets imagery. He gets picture making. It's
right.
Like, they're like posters, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. They are, yeah, but they work so well on covers. You know, they're not, because I think covers a lot of times have become sort of just a, you know, they don't tell a story. They don't really bring you in necessarily. His covers always bring you in, whatever he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. I went down, but, you know, again, when I was running the variant covers, I would call Dave all the time, you know, because he's a pal and he's a real pro. He's always on time. But I knew I was going to get back a piece and just go, holy shit, look what this guy did. But I was lucky. I did that with Frank Cho and I did that with Josh Middleton, who's astounding.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Ryan Sook. Ryan Sook's just crazy. The guy's just so talented, you know. It was a pleasure to do that job.
And the last thing on covers, this actually relates to you, is that run that you did with Tim Sale of Detective Comics in 2003 to 2004, which
yeah.
I think along with Johnson's Detective covers were just as good as Batman covers could possibly be. But those are brilliant that Tim did with you. And I'd like to know what the collaboration process was between the two of you.
I think Timmy was really at the top of his game when he was doing those. He was so, look, comic artists want to draw the great classic characters, the great villains, right? You don't want to do Tim would call me, okay, so who's this month? And I'd say, oh, it's the Joker. And he'd be cool, you know, he'd be really jazzed by it. And it wasn't, you know, oh, yeah, Batman's fighting Banana Man this month. And, you know, because then you're like, oh, shit, I have to figure out, I don't want to draw that, you know. But that run had so many great villains in it that Timmy just teed off on that stuff. And he was nice enough to let me color them. And they were really fun. It was kind of a triangle. It was, you know, the editor to the artist to the colorist. He did quite a few, as I recall.
Yeah, I think during that run, and you did almost all of them with him. I think you did 17 in total, and maybe more.
Yeah. I really distinctly remember some of them being really fun. And, you know, Timmy's such a great, you shouldn't call him Timmy, it makes it sound like he's 6 years old. Tim's such a great visualist, you know. His stuff is so idiosyncratic. It's a little like Paul Pope, where you're sort of like, this guy shouldn't be drawing comics. He's, you know, it's not John Buscema. It's not John Romita. It's not mainstream comics. It's their own vision. And fortunately, modern comics allow artists to do that. But I just love Tim's view of the world. Again, it's very influenced by movies, film noir, and poster artists from the 30s. You know, often I would call these guys, and especially Tim and Adam Hughes and Dave Johnson, and I would never really talk about the job. I would never say, well, what do you think he'll do on this cover? I would talk about, you know, we would talk about Norman Rockwell, or, geez, did you see that show on Netflix that was really well shot? Or you know, talk about famous American illustrators. And then they'd get off the phone and you just had a great conversation and you were happy to be an artist, a working artist. So they just kind of do their best work, I think. I wasn't tricking them. I certainly wasn't tricking them into doing their best work. I just like talking with these guys about stuff I'm interested in and stuff they're interested in.
And then you would get the best work.
Yeah.
That's great. I want to get to Solo super quickly because you're giving me all these, bringing up Pope and different things makes me want to talk about it. I just want to quickly ask you about the Guide to Coloring and Lettering Comics with Todd Klein. What was the origin of that project?
Watson Gunsell, the publisher, did a series of books with DC, the DC Guide to Creating, DC Guide to Penciling, DC Guide to Writing, DC Guide to Inking. And they had heavy hitters doing them. I mean, Denny O'Neill wrote the one on writing, and Klaus Janson did the one on penciling and inking. And they asked me to do the one on coloring. And I was like, oh, man, that's going to be a lot of work. I said to myself, that's going to be a lot of work. I really don't want to do that. But I don't want anybody else to do it. So I accepted it. And I think for years it was pretty highly regarded as sort of like the Bible of how to color comic books.
Right.
Has coloring changed to a degree that does it still apply?
The technical side of coloring has changed. I mean, you know, because Photoshop comes out with a new version every year and a half, whatever it is. But the first half of that book is about the aesthetics of color, and all that stuff doesn't change. It's, you know, it's kind of how to have good taste, how not to be all over the place with what you're putting on the page. You know, when comics first got into computer coloring, it was really gimmicky right off the bat. You had a lot of lens flares everywhere. You had people using way too much color and different colors. And, well, I have a million colors available to me. I'm going to use all 1 million of them. That ain't what it's about, you know. And you see some great colors like Laura Martin and, you know, all these, Dave Stewart, Trish Mulvihill, all these great, great colorists. They're not using all those colors. They're just using the computer like an art tool. It's just like a set of oil paints or it's a set of watercolors or good markers. It's the talent you bring to the table, not the tools that you have at your disposal.
Mm-hmm. So going now to New Frontier, because chronologically that's where we are, 2004, I want to focus on what your contribution was to the book as an editor. Like, did you work with him in terms of the whole package, the cover? It's so well designed from the first page to the last page, as is Solo. I mean, these are not just comics that have a cover that's not related to the next page and the next. It's a whole. And that's so clear in New Frontiers. So I want to hear not just what Darwin does, but what did you do to that project?
You know, look, I'd love to take credit for the look of New Frontier. You know, I'm a designer as well as an art director and an artist. And if you look at Solo, that's completely me, from the logo to the way it's designed, everything about that. And Wednesday Comics is completely me. I did the whole thing from a design standpoint and Batman Black and White. But Darwin, he did everything on that book. You know, I would talk to him literally every day about where the story was going and send pages in. But that's Darwin Cook's aesthetic. I'd love to steal some credit, but, you know, Darwin just, he did the whole thing from the covers to the inside design to obviously the art and the lighting. It was all Darwin. It goes back to Archie. Archie just said, facilitate these guys, make it easy for them to do their job, make it easy for them to sit down and write or draw. That's what I did with Darwin. I just let him.
So when those pages and the concepts were coming in, was everybody in the DC offices just in awe of it? Because it's just, you know, an amazing piece of work.
Yeah. I mean, this stuff is a little polarizing because so many people revere it, but you had a few people who thought, well, that's just cartoony. Oh, he's just doing Bruce Timm. He was influenced by Timm, also influenced by Kirby and Toth. But Darwin was Darwin. He, you know, I never liked when people said, gee, that's just too simple. That's just, you know, that's just cartooning. That's such a stupid thing to say. It's such an ill-informed thing to say. Like when people look at Toth stuff, a lot of people will say, oh, it's too simple.
Yeah.
Yeah, you try to do simple. Hey, it's easy to draw a shoulder and draw 40 lines for that shoulder. Try to do the one right line for that shoulder.
Right, there you go.
That's what's difficult.
Oh, that's great to know. And just says even more about Darwin that's so much just a coming completely from his head. Let's move to Solo. Solo, which was done between 2004 and 2006, which you said was one of your babies in terms of design and everything. Was it conceived by you to be a limited series of 12, or did you just want to see how far it would run?
I wanted to see how far it would go, and sales were good on it, but they weren't great on it. But it was more of like a real hardcore fan darling, you know.
People
look back on it and with great fondness. That I was just, you know, I was just being selfish. I just wanted to work with these artists, and I wanted to see. I remember though when Archie Goodwin worked for DC. I remember going in his office and saying, "Hey, I have this idea. Look, I love superheroes, but I'm a little tired of." Nobody does Western comics anymore. Nobody does romance comics anymore. Could we do a book that's just all romance comics or prison break stories? You know, and he's like, Well, the problem with that is if you do one issue that's all Westerns, then the next issue is prison stories. You get no momentum because it's a completely different flavor. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right. And I thought about it, and I was like, well, maybe if the hook is the artist, then you're going to walk into a comic shop and see, oh, Tim Sale, I like his stuff. So you're going to pick it up. And you'll be tricked into reading, you know, all the different genres that I asked the guys and gals to do. And it, I was just looking at the collection of the solo stuff the other day, and man, there was some cool stuff in there. I was really lucky. There was some really cool stuff in there.
Well, before we get to the ones that did get made, I want to just ask about the ones that didn't, in terms of, were there artists that you planned on having or that you talked to about it and it didn't happen because you ran out of time or because they couldn't do it? I know Kaluta said something on our Facebook group about how he had so wanted to do that and then it didn't happen.
Yeah, I remember mentioning it to Kaluta. I don't know that I was ever actually asked him officially, but I love my stuff, so I would have been cool. Walt Simonson was going to do one, and he wanted to interconnect all the stories. And I was like, cool, yeah, great. And I know he's having deadline problems on some other project he was trying to wrap up. So Solo got canceled before he got a chance to do much more than maybe a couple character designs. But his idea was he wanted each story to be different characters and different times through history. And the connecting tissue was a coin, that each character had the same coin throughout history. And he eventually did it as, once Solo was canceled, he did it as a graphic novel called The Judas Coin.
That was going to be a Solo project.
That was the initial Solo, yeah, that he never got around to doing. I forget why he couldn't do the Solo, but he had to step off. And then, like, maybe 2 years later, he pitched it as a graphic novel. And I'm glad he did, because it's really a beautiful piece.
Yeah, I like it. I read that.
It seemed like some of the people who went and eventually did Wednesday Comics would have been, I mean, Kelly Baker is the most obvious one to me, but there were people like that that just cried out that they should have been on, gotten to do a Solo issue.
Yeah, I got to use a lot of those people. You're right. You got to use a lot of those people on Wednesday Comics. But, I mean, Jim Lee started drawing an issue of Solo. I think he did 3 pages, and he is officially the busiest guy on the planet, so he never proceeded with it. I really like Howard Porter's work, and he showed me his sketchbooks one time, and they were just like, his comic stuff is great, but his sketchbooks are just like from another world. He said, oh, right, man, you should do this stuff. And then it was canceled. And Sienkiewicz was going to do one, and George Pratt was going to do one, but the book was canceled.
Oh, those both would have been great. Well, let's talk about the ones that actually did get published. Did you start with Tim Sale just because he finished first, or was there a strategy to how you were going to do these in order?
Well, obviously, when you kick off a project, you want to get a real popular, you want to get a real popular creator on it. And Timmy was very popular at that time. He was just coming off, I guess, the stuff he did with Loeb for us. I have to stop saying us, for DC Comics, Dark Victory. So I knew he had a real following. And he's really an artist's artist. I got my cake and eat it too. I got to hire an artist I really loved and respected their work, but also somebody who was really popular.
Right.
And you actually colored one of those stories on that first issue, right? Did you do Prom Night?
Did I do Prom Night? Which one's Prom Night? I forget which one that is. I know I colored the film noir one, the Azzarello one, the almost black and white one.
Oh, did you do that one?
Yeah, which I think is Tim's best work to date. I think that's just astounding. I know I colored the last story, which is about his mom and dad, which was monochromatic, like green and tan.
Yeah, it's a nice one.
Yeah.
Isn't that where he's going off to the prom? Maybe that's the one I love is that he's in the driveway. He's walking away, and his mom, there's a picture of his mom and dad looking, but
you know, you're right. I think you're right. Yeah. I know it's about, they talk about a Frank Sinatra song a lot in that story. So that's,
yeah, that's what it is. It's Prom Night. It's my favorite page from that issue is that one, as good as the noir one is. It's just, that one's personal to me. I just love it.
Real nice. And I shouldn't say this, but I actually wrote one of them also. Hey, I shouldn't say that though.
Oh, really? Well,
because it's not on the official credit, you mean?
Yeah. Tim had, like a year earlier, Tim had done, he was dating a girl and they went like on vacation to the beach. And he drew this like 3-page story of him and her walking on the beach. And it was really beautifully drawn and painted, but it had no dialogue at all. And he sent me scans of the pages because I love his art and he wanted to share it. And I said, oh, this is gorgeous. And just as a joke, I put dialogue in there, like, and they're, you know, I made it where they're having a fight on the beach and he's all pissed off because he's got to go back and draw, you know, Spider-Man Red, White, and Blue or whatever that book was, and the deadlines and all that stuff. You know, it was just a gag. And then when a year or two later, when he did Solo, I said, you know, he said, let's print that artwork. I'll draw a few more pages to it. I'll fill it out a little, but I want you to dialogue it for real. So I wrote the dialogue that's in that story, which had nothing to do with the images, really. I just made up this story about a guy who has to kill his girlfriend for that. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I shouldn't have said that because Tim's going to be real mad at me that I said that.
So the second issue, you went with somebody that I think at the time wouldn't have necessarily been instinctively another big seller, which was Richard Corbin, primarily known for his earlier magazine work. What was your decision to go with him next? And also, what did you think of that issue?
It was an absolutely fascist, mercenary decision. I'm a really big Richard Corbin fan. I mean, from back in the days when there was such a thing as underground comics, and he would draw these incredibly bizarre, gorgeous comic books. I had asked him to draw Batman Black and White, 8-pager. I think it was in the first issue. I think it was. And we became kind of friendly, and I asked him to do the Solo. And one of the great, great artists. I really loved what he ended up doing for that book.
Mm-hmm. And he wrote all those stories.
I think he wrote like maybe, he certainly wrote about 90% of them. I think there was, oh no, John Aquitty wrote the Spectre story, I think.
Let's talk about that for a second, because it's interesting to me. One, Dave Stewart colored it, and it shows. It's great. But also, wasn't Corbin at this point in a real religious phase of his life?
I don't know if that's true. I honestly don't know. He's a real interesting guy, but I don't know that he was ever. I'm not sure. Honestly, not sure.
I had read that, which was interesting because the Spectre is a tricky character in that context. But I thought his visual of the Spectre was really original. I had not seen the all-encompassing use of white the way that it was used in that story. I thought was really fun.
Yeah, big time, really cool.
And the third issue is Paul Pope, one of the best. I think that's one of the best issues of the whole series for me. I love that.
Yeah.
And if you don't fully appreciate Jack Kirby, Paul Pope surely does, because that OMAC recreation is just so much fun.
Yeah, another guy who just really has a real respect for the history of comics and brings his incredibly unique take to that world. I think I may have colored a couple of those stories, as I recall.
Oh, cool.
And the next was Chaykin. What's your take on Howard?
I love Howard. Howard's the greatest. I really like that last story where he talks about how as a kid he was too scared to read horror comic books. I love the autobiographical nature of that story.
That's an aspect I really like about this series, when any of them actually bring that in, and we'll get to Darwin Cook's beautiful story in terms of that next, where he does that with World's Window, which I assume is somewhat autobiographical.
It absolutely is, yeah. Well, it's like, one of the later issues with Sergio Aragonés, and on one of the pages, like maybe page 2, he's talking on the phone to his editor, and he's making all excuses up why he's late drawing his issue of Solo, and the editor was me, so he actually said, oh, yes, Mark, I've already drawn half the story or whatever. But I got the page again, and I'm like, holy shit, Sergio Aragonés is talking about me, like specifically talking about me and mentioning me in the comic book.
That's cool.
Yeah, I that's also one of my favorite issues because it's so autobiographical. It's like half autobiography and half taking me back to Plop. And it's just so much fun. I think that issue really works well. The only thing I'd say about the Chaykin one was it's not just that last story, but the one before that is so EC focused too, because it reads just like one of the preachies that Wally Wood did.
Yeah.
you know, and so it seems like it was. So that was, that leads me to a question. Who decided the order of the stories? And that was that you, or did the artist say, here they are and here's how I want them to be told?
It was mostly me figuring that out. Some artists would say, gee, I'd really like it to go in this order. And if I agreed, I certainly would say, yeah, that sounds cool. But I did it. I had to do something editorially on it. So, I would say, hey, I think this is a good flow because you have a Western next to a superhero next to a romance. I would always plot it out. Like, I would always do a book map with little thumbnails of each page. So I would, I'd know the flow of how the book went. So you don't have two really long stories next to each other or two Westerns next to each other.
But it was nice that there were a lot of Westerns in the series altogether. The next one, issue 6 with Jordy Burnett, has that stalking horse story, again with Dave Stewart. And it's one of the things when I was going through it, re-looking at this, was, boy, those Stewart colored ones just jump out at you. Like, you recognize, oh, I bet that's one of his too, because you just, it's just, there's something that just pops out of the page with his colors.
Yeah. Dave's one of the few guys I'm real jealous of because he's a better colorist than I am. And that's probably why I stopped doing coloring, because he's just too good.
But I know.
And he's the nicest guy, he's like really laid back and stuff. And he's, man, what a talent. The stuff he's doing with Douglas Mignola and, those solo stories.
And then, let's see, Michael Allred, that issue just seemed like he was so happy to be playing in superhero land. And I don't think it's just because he's the first one that's all he did in this was, it seemed like it was every story was, now I'm going to do Kirby Fourth World, and now I'm going to do Teen Titans, and I'm going to do a pinup of Metal Men. It was, he embraced that aspect of it like no one had before him in terms of the series.
The rule I made up was, okay, it's short stories. You can do whatever genre you want. You can write whatever you want relatively. And the only rule is you have to do at least one superhero story, one DC superhero story. So you get all these artists who wanted to do different genres, science fiction, and they sort of begrudgingly would do the superhero. But Allred just loved superheroes. Like you said, he did all those characters. He did all the superhero stories he wanted to do.
Yeah, it seems he really likes the Silver Age of superheroes. It seems like that's a big influence on him.
Yeah. Yeah, we really shared that, because we were both big 60s fans of the 60s and 70s stuff. And,
right.
And I don't know if you've ever met Mike and Laura Allred.
No.
But they are truly the nicest, nicest people you'll ever meet. They're real decent human beings. They're just optimistic about life and how lucky they feel they are to be working in the business and drawing their heroes. I can't say enough about those two people.
Oh, that's great. And she's super talented, too. She's a great colorist.
Man, yeah.
What a team. So then Teddy Christensen, and I love this issue an awful lot, too. I think the art in this is just fantastic. And it's got a real theme to it. And it's just, it's a beautiful cover. It's, the interiors are great. That love story in that is just really nice. Were you pleased with that issue?
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear you say that you liked it, because Teddy was such a polarizing artist. And like, we did an issue with Damian Scott, and people came into my office and said, wow, this, he's such a modern artist. It really took balls to use him on this project. And, I really love the stuff they said. And then the other 50% of the people came in and said, this isn't comics. This is crap. What are you publishing? And I would kick them out of my office because they were wrong. But that's the challenge of Solo, was to use artists who I really liked. And knowing that Teddy Christensen is just an incredible, incredible artist, but some people might not like it, which it can't all be mainstream,
Mm-hmm.
No, it was quiet, and it had a art with a capital A feel to it that I think there's a whole segment of comic fans who probably didn't respond to that. And it's kind of amazing that he worked at DC, and that some of these guys worked at DC when they don't have styles that are traditionally friendly.
Yeah. And the difficult thing was Solo was one artist pulling all the wait for a single issue. So if you didn't like, if you don't like Tim Sale, you're not going to buy that issue. But with Batman Black and White, I was able to like the very first issue. I asked Jim Lee to do the cover because he was incredibly popular and a great, great artist. But if you look in that issue, there's a Jose Munoz story in there.
Right.
That most kids had never heard of at that time because he was a European artist that I really worshipped. And so, yes, I kind of tricked people into buying the book and getting something that was good for them without them knowing it.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so then there was, so there was the Scott Hampton one, and that's an old friend of yours. He did, yeah. And were you pleased with that that issue? He mixed up his styles. That's the one where, like, you could see a root with most of the artists, like, even though they differed the approach to it, but his are so different from story to story in that issue.
Yeah, he's such a multi-talented artist. He's got such variety to his stuff. He can draw any way he wants, which is such a rarity. Some of those stories in there are my absolute favorites in the entire series. You know, he did a story about a real EC Comics pastiche in there, and there's a story about a little boy who meets Batman, but it's really not Batman, it's a guy.
Yeah, I love that one.
Oh my God, it just brings tears to my eyes. I think it's just beautiful.
And then we do the Damian Scott one, which I fully appreciate being polarizing. And again, that's fascinating because where you have the one story where Brian Stelfreeze inks it and it like changes it completely. And I mean, it seems so much more accessible on some levels. And I like that. And then I turn to the last story, though. And that double page spread on the bat is like the coolest thing in the world. So I think it's a strong issue that ought to be considered. And I bet it was probably the most polarizing issue maybe the last one, which we can get to.
Yeah, you know, it really was. People loved it and people hated it. And that's fine. That's cool.
And then everybody loved Aragonés, right? I mean, that issue had
Yeah, that was a no brainer.
Did that sell better?
No, they all, you know, it sold about medium. You know, obviously the Tim Sales and the guys who were real popular at the time, those sold really well.
Yeah, I would think Sale and Cook would be the ones that were probably just easy ones.
Yeah. The series sold fairly well. It wasn't a big success, but it was a big creative success. That's okay.
And then Brendan McCarthy is the probably most challenging one. I mean, like, that's like, wow, the DC readers probably were not ready for that. I mean, their brains probably exploded.
Yeah, I don't know that I was ready for that either. He's such a mad genius, and I wanted to publish a genius, you know, but it's not real accessible. But, man, there's some creative stuff there.
And that's one where it has it goes from page to page. It's not just like four stories. It has a unity of insanity running throughout the entire thing.
Yeah, you feel like you took acid and read a comic book.
Yep, that's pretty much what it was. And it's like, if you didn't know, just thinking about it, you could look at that issue and say, oh, well, that killed Solo. that's the end of that.
Mm.
So anyway, I want to thank you for that series because it's such a great treat for people who really love comic art, especially because you got it in a way that you don't often get it. So thanks for indulging us in talking about that in the detail. Any other thoughts about Solo?
No, I there is that weird wave of nostalgia, like, oh, that's when comics were good, you know, from some people. And I'm real proud to have been a part of that. And I appreciate that you liked it and that people do remember it really well. It was an experiment. It was maybe a little indulgent on my part. But hey, as long as it sold okay and people liked it, then that's good enough for me.
And the package and everything, when you say that that's all you, it is one of the most memorable runs in terms of how it's designed and the visuals of cover to cover and back to back. It's such a well-conceived book, not even talking about the content, but just the thematics of it, visual thematics of it.
Cool, thank you.
So, Alex, you want to?
Yeah.
I'm worn out for a few minutes. Talk about Wednesday Comics.
So, Wednesday Comics, that was 2009. And I loved it. I read all 12 of them. And I just love how it's arranged like a Sunday Comics from the newspapers back when they were early adventure strips. So, how did the Wednesday Comics come to be?
Like many people, I am a fan of the old Sunday Comics, you know, the old comic strips in the newspaper. You know, they used to be so big that were physically so large, and then over the years they got smaller and smaller, unfortunately. But you know, as a fan of comics and comic strips, I really miss those days of, you know, I'd go back and collect stuff that was around in the 30s and 40s, and you know, I was introduced to Crazy Cat, you know, George Herrmann's Crazy Cat,
right,
which was certainly, obviously, before my time, before our time. But it's a different world, you know. We forget because we never knew that This is one of the popular movies and television, you know, and then right up through all the adventure strips, like you mentioned, you know, Harry and the Pirates was as big as any Star Trek movie, any Star Wars movie, any James Bond movie. It was just revered, and kids across America loved that shit. And I was very good friends with an editor named Joey Cavalieri at DC, and Joey is a real knowledgeable guy, and he kept saying, "Hey, man, we should do something with the old strip," and I had the same exact idea, and you know, so I put it together, and it was really fun. I mean, it was a weird experiment. I wonder how people look back on it, because it was these newspapers that were folded up, and you know, I liked it. I really liked working with it and working with the people on it. I worked with, you know, some really great names again, but I sort of do wonder how people look back on it.
Well, I mean, I love it. And I looked back on it the other day. Was it hard to pitch to DC at the time? Were they like, well, this sounds a little too avant-garde, or was it a full green light from day one?
No, definitely not a full green light. I was just mentioning the other day in an interview about how Paul Levitz, who was the big boss at DC, would always give me a hard time. You know, I'd come into his office all excited about, hey, I want to do this new project. And he'd look at me like, no, we can't do that. That's not going to sell. You know, research has shown that black and white comics don't sell or whatever. He always pull it. And he's an incredibly intelligent guy. And he probably had reason, you know, had hardcore data to prove, to back up what he was saying. But he always would say no to me. And I would always get upset and stalk out of his office, storm out of his office, and then go pitch it again another 2 months later. And I think I eventually wore him down on a lot of this stuff.
I see.
But yeah, I mean, I even got to the point where I did a big, you know, I pasted together comic books in the size and shape of Wednesday Comics to show him exactly what it would look like.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think he could tell from my passion that, yeah, okay, let's go ahead and do this.
Right. That you probably treat it right.
Get out of my office.
Then how did you select the artists and writers?
Again, just as a fan, you know, I always think the best thing to do as an editor is to come up with projects that you would want to read, that you would want to put on your bookshelf.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I wanted to work with Paul Pope and Neil Gaiman and Eduardo Risso again. You know, I asked a few of them who weren't able to. Like, I wanted Tim Sale to do the Batman one on the cover, but he wasn't supposed to do that. I think he was doing something at Marvel.
Yeah.
But I was just as happy to get Eduardo Risso to do it and Azzarello.
Right. So Jim and I are going to talk about some of the individual ones. So Metamorpho, story by Neil Gaiman, art by Mike Allred. It's an interesting team up of those two talents, I thought. And it's about Metamorpho accompanying Simon Stagg to an expedition in Antarctica. So, you know, how was it receiving those pages from them? And did you give them ideas on layouts before getting the pages from them? Or was that just kind of they created it and sent it to you? You know, how was that? What was that process?
It was, you know, the artists always worked with the writers, and they designed their pages. They came up with how they would approach the visuals. I never asked any of them to do them a certain way, a specific way. That was all them, you know, and some people drew them because, again, they're really oversized pages. Some people drew them in separate panels, and then they photoshopped all the panels together because the physical size of a piece of art paper to draw it on would have been enormous. But sure enough, you know, Allred drew them full size, and he showed me the original. They were like posters. They were incredibly big.
Wow.
Yeah. Paul Pope, too, if you see those originals, they're enormous.
Right.
But that was all, you know, again, Archie Goodwin, hire the best and let them do what they do. Don't tell, you know, Joe Kubert how to draw Sergeant Rod Page. He knows what he's doing.
Right. And then Demon, Catwoman, the story by Walt Simonson, art by Brian Stelfreeze. And Catwoman is trying to steal an artifact from Jason Blood. And it was a Morgan Le Fay plot or a ploy. And then they actually sparked their own little romance between Catwoman and Jason Blood. So none of that's supposed to be canon, right? These are just basically fun imaginary tales for this format, right?
I honestly think all the stuff I did editorially, Batman Black and White, Solo, Lindsay Comics, I think none of that is considered canon, really, because it was just fun stuff, you know?
Right, like artistic statements, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking DC. Does canon is that even in a vocabulary any longer?
I will not answer that question. I don't think anybody did anything that contradicted the basic tenets and canon of the characters. You know, Superman was Superman. He wasn't smoking a cigarette on page two, you know?
Right. Sure. So then the Hawkman, I love that because there's an Alex Raymond vibe with Hawkman, obviously, and then the action and the illustration, it just had such a warrior approach to it. But the story and art was by Kyle Baker, and Kedar Hall fights off airplane hijackers. There's an alien invasion. He ends up on Dinosaur Island. Aquaman kind of helps him out at the end. He loses his wings. But what a fun story, because you have, you know, the orchestration of the birds and planes and the hijackers and alien invasions and monster islands or dinosaur islands. What was it like seeing those pages? What were some of these pages just more than you expected getting?
Oh my God, Kyle's such a mad, another one of these few mad geniuses that pages would come in and I'm like, what? Like, you know, he's like, oh, I want to do the whole story like as 3D graphics, you know, I want it to look real dimensional. And I'm like, but Kyle, can't you just draw it with a pen? You know, I mean, like your old stuff. And no, I got this great idea. You know, Kyle is this weird mixture of, he's sort of a cross between like Jack Davis and Will Eisner, you know?
Right. That's interesting.
There's a real fun nature to his stuff. And man, he goes down as one of the geniuses. Like, he's like Robert Crumb. He's just
wow,
a different way than normal human beings.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. So then, Sergeant Rock, story by Adam Kubert and art by Joe Kubert, which is awesome because I was a big fan of the Green Beret strip. I've read every single one, I think. And Sergeant Rock is captured by Nazis and tortured, and he escapes the torture. You know, this was obviously toward the end of Joe Kubert's life, but, you know, were you a Joe Kubert fan with his earlier stuff? And how did it feel getting these pages and overseeing pages from him?
It's Joe Kubert. Yeah, I just... Holy cow, you talk about Kirby and Toth. I mean, Joe Kubert's right there. Any comics artist just worth his salt is just the biggest Joe Kubert fan. Mm-hmm. You know, when I knew Joe, I got to know him because we worked together a little bit on that and about a few other projects. And he ran that school out in New Jersey, out in Dover. And, I'd go visit him to do some business and stuff. And I'd be like, you're going to think I'm a moron, but I'd be literally like, holy shit, you're Joe Kubert. Oh my God, Joe Kubert. And he'd look at me like, Mark, take it easy. You know, what's wrong with you? You know, I just couldn't help it. It's Joe Kubert. So yeah, so I'm working with him and Andy on that, which really, I was a little nervous because when you draw something you don't like, you're going to tell Joe Kubert to redraw something. It never happened, but yeah.
Yeah, all those pages are great. I mean, he was great till the very end, right? I mean, he still kept that skill through all those decades. So Superman, story by John Arcudi, art by Lee Bermejo. It's kind of an interesting story in that an alien kind of, they give him doubts about his connection with Earth. But those panels, Superman, even in his argument with Batman in the story, it just had such a heroic portrayal of Kal-El. You know, what'd you feel of the sequence of those pages, the quality of that illustration when that was coming your way?
You know, I'm such a big fan of Lee's work, Lee Bermejo. I think Arcudi is one of the great writers in comics. Mm-hmm. I wish he would do more mainstream stuff, you know, to play with those characters. Every time he does, it's really great.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and Lee Bermejo, geez, I hate the guy because he's this great-looking guy. He's this great artist. He's really smart. He's really talented. You know, it's like the guy's got everything going for him in life. And he's a good pal, but God, I love his work. I'm glad to see him successful as he is.
Yeah, that's awesome. So Batman, story by Brian Azzarello, art by Eduardo Risso. And there's a murdered man's estate and a femme fatale. And it was interesting because although he catches the dead man's wife as the person who ended up killing him or being responsible for his death, Batman kisses her at the end right before she dies. So you can tell he likes the bad girl. That seems to be an interesting thing with Batman. What'd you think of that? How does that hold up as a Batman story?
I thought it was great. I thought it was a nice plot cover. You got your flagship character on the front cover, and Azzarello is always a great writer. Always a great writer.
Right.
And Risso, I'm such a big fan of. You know, I haven't looked at those issues in quite a while. I should relook. I seem to remember getting that page in. I may be misremembering. I apologize if I am, but it seems to me that when I saw it, he's kissing her and she dies.
Right.
But she's going to say something like she's going to spill the beans about something. And he keeps kissing her and not allowing her to say what she was going to say. Am I misremembering? Like, he doesn't actually kill her.
Well, when I read it, it looked like she realized it was Bruce Wayne. And then she says, Bruce, ? And then he kisses her and there's like, you know, blood on their faces a little too.
Yeah, like I think he, the way I read it, like he holds the kiss a little too long and she died. So she can't say out loud what she's thinking.
Oh, that's funny. Well, because the cops were right there too.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
All right, Jim, you talk about yours.
Okay. I've just got a couple I want to talk about. The ones that I tend to love the most are the ones that it doesn't look like a comic book that's just drawn big, but instead looks like it's doing something like the old sheets did. Like it looks like a newspaper sheet. I thought that Sook just nailed it with his Hal Foster instead of Jack Kirby Commandy. That's one of my favorite out of everything that was done on the Wednesday comics.
Oh yeah. And how beautifully illustrated was that?
I think it almost changed the notion of command. I mean, it's awfully hard to do that when Kirby creates it, but I think that Ryan Sook made such an impression on that character with that it actually carries over. That's how some people now have that in their head as Commandy, which is really something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just great. That was a standout. The other standout for me was I think that Pope Strange Adventures is some of his best work ever, and he's got a lot of best work, but that's just, talk about trippy. That's like a whole different experience from, I thought, anything else.
Yeah, absolutely agree. You know, I always thought those pages reminded me of like San Francisco concert poster art.
Yeah, totally.
You know, like I always wish somebody would have printed those on real nice paper, like as posters. I thought that would have been real cool.
Yeah, just the strongest stuff. I'm crazy about. Those are the two that I out of, besides some of the things that Alex mentioned, those are the two that really stand out for me that I could just look at over and over and seem like something that you would see on a comic strip newspaper page rather than anything else. I really like the Dave Bullock Dead Man. I mean, I think he just, a couple of those where he uses the entire page is just really, really crazy and fun. It looks like he's just having such a good time doing this. And,
yeah.
Really, you know, that's what I like on that one.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's got a real power to his stuff. I really wish that he was doing more comics these days. I thought he was a real force. He was a real force around that time.
I agree. I loved his work.
He was real good friends with Darwin. They had worked together at Warner Brothers Animation. And you saw a little bit of Darwin in there. You saw a little bit of Jack Kirby. But Bullock's stuff is all Bullock. You know, I wish he would come back and do some comics.
And the other one I would say that I liked because it was really using the concept of that page was the Flash comics. I tended not to like the main superhero stories as much as some of the fringe stuff, but and that was just my taste. But the Flash one, because it broke it up in that Iris West and just the logo of Iris West and doing those two things on the same page, I followed that with a lot of joy. And then like halfway through when they take away Iris and they put in Gorilla Grodd and suddenly it looks like a Tarzan strip. That was exciting to me.
I thought that was, who was that? That was Carl Kershaw.
Yeah.
And I forget, I'm my memory.
Brenda Fletcher. Or Brendan Fletcher.
Brendan Fletcher, yeah. Yeah, you know, I thought that was honestly, I thought they played with the possibilities of the format more than any other of those stories in Wednesday Comics.
Yeah, that's why I'm including that with as good as Sook and Pope was. I thought they were the ones that really got the concept. That's
yeah,
such fun stuff. Cool. Did you want to do a second series and just it just wasn't going to come together?
It was a lot to put together because as an editor, I was one of the rare editors who actually I did all my own, you know, production, you know, putting the pages together and getting ready for the printer. I even do all that stuff myself, and that's a lot of work. So I was sort of like, wow, when I was done, man, I was really done. But then like 2-3 years went by and you kind of forget the pain you've been put through or you put yourself through. You know, and I pitched it again and to DiDio and to Dan DiDio, and he said, yeah, we'd like to do that again, but we want to do it as digital comics, you know, direct to digital. And I was like, but that doesn't really make sense to me because the charm of Wednesday Comics is that you would hold this big piece of paper in your hand, and really the size was the cool thing. But if it's digital, you could blow it up. You could blow any picture up, big or small, you know? So
That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, that would be an interesting project to do in a Scott McCloud, here's all the possibilities of doing it digital, but it's not, it violates the entire premise of what this was.
I thought so. So I kind of backed off of it. I started talking to a few people like Harlan Ellison. I asked Harlan to write, he's a great science fiction writer. I asked Harlan to write a story for me, and he said, man, I have the greatest idea. And Walt Simonson was going to draw that. So I started lining them up, but then it just kind of fell apart.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to have one last thing to talk about, which was the Before Watchmen series, starting with the Before Watchmen series. And I just wanted to ask you first, what was your feeling about it? I mean, about Watchmen and Alan Moore's wishes. Did you have any trouble getting your head around that, doing that project?
I'll tread lightly here, but I disagreed with a lot of, although I respect Alan Moore, I disagree with a lot of, he worked on other creators' characters that the companies owned. Why can't we work on the characters you created? There was a lot of backlash, you know, it was a kind of a funky time. It was, people were, again, very split right down the middle. Azzarello and all these guys, you know, we're not going to just put anybody on these things. But I was so proud of what Darwin did on Minutemen.
Did you have input into the approach of those ones that you edited?
You know, they would tell me what they were thinking of doing, and I'd say, oh, that sounds good. Or, like, I remember the Amanda Connor one, Silk Spectre. The bad guy was supposed to be Frank Sinatra. Like, literally, Frank Sinatra was supposed to be the bad guy. He was going to look like Sinatra. And Legal said, don't even think about it, you know? And so I think it would have been a slightly better project if it could have been actually Frank Sinatra being a bad guy.
I want to bring us to the end of DC, and I don't know, Mark, what you want to say or how you want to say it in relation to that, except that this year your time with DC ended, and to the incredible irritation of many, many of us. What do you want to say about it?
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It was kind of heartwarming to see the response back from everybody on Facebook and so many artists and writers and creators and fans and stuff that, you know, it made me feel like I didn't just waste 26 years of my life working for a company. But yeah, I mean, without getting into too much, corporate America stepped in, AT&T bought Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers owned DC Comics. You know, maybe they don't care that much about the creativity of this stuff. And, you know, they had to cut money, and I made a good paycheck, and they saw me as a dollar amount, which is, okay, whatever. You know, look, business is business, and I think that's something people forget. Comic books are a business, and DC is there to make money. Marvel is there to make money, and hopefully you can make some art along the way. So I don't begrudge AT&T for their business decisions. It was time for me to move on anyway. You know, I wanted to get back to doing my own artwork after all those years, and I've started doing that, and I've got some really cool projects for early next year that I'm working on now, and I'm actually having a good time drawing for the first time in a long time.
That's nice.
It sounded like your job was a real time drain and exhaustion, such that you didn't get to be the artist that you obviously, you know, are.
Yeah, but I'm such a, you know, I had all those years, I had that insecurity about my own art with that I sort of hid behind the job. Look, at the end of the day, it was a great job. Man, I did some fun stuff on that job. In DC, I love DC Comics. I worked with some great people. You know, Karen Berger and Mike Carlin and all these great, great people in the office. You know, I get to work with Jim Lee every day. I mean, that's pretty cool. I'm not too crazy about one or two other people, but there's no need to get into that. It was a great, great job. And I think it's okay. It's a good thing to be part of a collective to make. I like to think maybe I made comics a little better from being a behind the scenes guy. But you're right. I did put my own artwork on the back burner. And, you know, maybe it's time to do some art again.
Right. There you go. And I think a lot of people are excited about that too, about that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So besides comics, this is kind of like more of a side thing that we're mentioning at the end of the interview is you worked on cards for a long time. In the 1990s, you did a series of cards on the history of the Negro Leagues for baseball. And then that was collected in a book for Abrams Publishing in 2007. You've done some Star Wars trading cards, Temple of Dooms cards. So, and you were able to exercise your illustration muscle on these. Can you tell us a little bit about the card career and your involvement in that?
Sure. I'm a big baseball nut. I mean, it's really a passion of mine. And I did the those Negro League cards for Eclipse way back when. I think it was like 1989, I think. And then they collected them as a book. Charlie Kochman at Abrams collected them. And trading cards are fun because, you know, being a comic book artist, an interior artist, is really difficult. Man, you have to draw six panels on a page. It's a lot of work, as I'm finding out right now in my new freelance career. But, you know, you do a single image, you do a cover, or you do a trading card. You spend a day on it, you're in, you're out, you come up with a cool image, and you don't have to draw Spider-Man swinging across a city, you know? So, yeah, I always loved doing cards. They were really, really fun. And, I on the baseball topic, I just finished my second baseball book. It's about the 100 greatest baseball players of all time.
Oh, wow.
Illustrated. Yeah, and I've been working for the last 5 years in my free time, but I'm doing it as a Kickstarter program for the beginning of next season, the 2020 season. So,
oh, nice.
I hope you keep an eye out for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, we'll make sure that it's mentioned on the Facebook group page too. That's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Mark Chiarello, for joining Jim and I today on the Comic Book Historian Podcast. It was really exciting for us to talk about your involvement in comics history, various key figures in comic history that you worked with, as well as yourself. We really appreciate you joining us today and taking time out of your schedule to do this. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I apologize for talking so much myself, but it was just great talking to you about all of this.
No, I really thanks for having me. You guys did a great job. You made it really pretty easy for me to talk about myself.
Good. One last thing, Carmine Infantino. He was a editorial art director, then he was publisher. You know, do you feel like your art position and art directorial position was, were there any analogies going on there between your involvement with DC and his?
Maybe in a minor way. I think, you know, Carmine was right out of the show Mad Men. Uh-huh. You know, it was the 60s and he was a cigar smoking guy who would tell people what to do. And he was incredibly creative. It was a different world. I like to think I was, you know, again, I like to hope people, you know, maybe think of me in the same sentence as Archie Goodwin, although I know that's incredibly egotistical to say. And if I learned something from Archie, then man, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, maybe that's right. The Archie Goodwin of the 2000s. I can go with that for sure.
Oh, thanks.